Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Golf Talk Live, and thank you for tuning into the program. I'm, of course, your host, Ted Odorico, and we're going to start the broadcast, of course, with another great round of Coach's Corner, but do it a little bit differently tonight, and I'm going to talk about that in just a minute here, but and I'll bring up my guest panel this week as well. But just first, let me remind everybody, of course, the broadcast is live every Thursday evening on Blog Talk Radio from 6 to 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, or 7 to 9 for your for those of you on the East Coast. And if you want to tune into the program live, you can follow the link at www.blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive, or you can just go to blogtalkradio.com and type up in the search key Golf Talk Live, and that will bring you there as well. Also, if you want to call in and speak to any of the guests or myself during the live broadcast, you can do so by calling area code 646-716-4667, or you can email questions or comments to me at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. And if you want to get updates on social media, you can do so by following the Golf Talk Live blog on facebook.com, and make sure that you throw a few likes while you're there as well. Appreciate you if you like the program. And also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, also update the show on Twitter at Ted and Buck CEO, that's CEO in cap letters. And also, don't forget to check out the Golf Talk Live website at www.golftalklive.blog.com. But thanks for tuning in tonight, guys. I appreciate it. And joining me a little bit later in the show, after the Coach's Corner segment, of course, is my special guest this evening, John Weir. He's the founder of the Mental Golf Academy in Orlando and creator of the Mental Caddy and performance coach to collegiate and professional golfers around the world. So he's going to be joining me here in about an hour's time. So appreciate, again, you guys tuning in. And on the panel tonight, of course, is one of my returning favorites, Mr. Robert Foreman. He's also known as Bob, of course. He's a certified golf fitness instructor and director of golf fitness academies at High Point Regional in High Point, North Carolina. And he also holds a master's degree in exercise physiology and certifications through the Titleist Performance Institute and Flexor Motor Learning Program. So Bob's on the program as well. And if you want to learn a little bit more about him, visit his website at www.golffitcarolina.com. And also on the program as well, I'm excited to have Mike Lawrence. He's a life member of the PGA. And also, he is a graduate of Clemson University some years back, played there during 75 and 79, through 79, excuse me, played in 10 majors over the years, and has three South Carolina Open titles. He works with TGM Golf, the R3 Approach, and the AAG Golf Group here down in South Carolina. And you can also contact through Brookstone Meadows Golf and Tennis Club. And his websites, if you want to learn more, is at www.mikelawrencegolf.com and also at www.tgmgolf.com. You can find him there as well. Gentlemen, welcome to Coach's Corner.
Good evening.
Pleasure being back, Mike, Ted.
Yeah.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you coming on and pitching in as you do all the time, and it's great to have you back here. And I hope I got everything right, and if I didn't, I apologize. We'll work that out. But, guys, as I mentioned to you off-air, I'm doing something a little bit different tonight, and I'm going to sort of launch a new series that I've been working on, and we're going to get a little bit of input into that tonight, and then we're going to talk about some other things here in the meantime. But, of course, on the Coach's Corner panel every week, you guys out there listening to the program have an opportunity, or any of your golfing buddies, to send an email, questions into the program, and be able to pick some the brains of some of the best coaches and teaching pros in the business. I'll have a panel, of course, every week. Some weeks, of course, I'll take a break, but we cover a new topic, plus we'll help some of you weekend warriors out there as well. So don't forget, you can call into the program if you want at 646 716-4667, or you can email questions to the Coach's Corner panel at questions.golftalklive@gmail.com. But as I said, tonight we're going to do something a little bit different on Coach's Corner. And I didn't get all the details with the guys off air, but I'm going to get into a little more specifics now. Over the next several weeks and months, we're going to discuss a new series that I put together called in Coach's Corner called Plan for Success series. And the series will consist of seven components, and then, of course, the eighth component will put everything together. And the first one, of course, is going to be fitness for golf. We're going to talk in great detail about some of the things that we need to do. And, of course, I've got a great fitness guy on tonight, Bob. He's going to help talk a little bit about it tonight. We're not getting into too much quite yet. The second part, a component of it, of course, is nutrition, choosing the right foods. And believe it or not, what you eat and put into your body is certainly going to help your golf game. We'll talk a lot about that as well in the weeks and that to come. Also, the equipment end of it, we're going to talk about everything from purchasing new equipment when you need to and being properly fitted. We're going to be talking about the fitting process as well. Of course, we're going to get into instruction. That's really what the program is about, is to help you guys out there, including how to search and find the right teacher for you. Number five, of course, is practice, building a workstation and effective practice techniques. We're going to help you build yourself, and we know that everybody's a little time restrained out there right now, so we're going to help you make good use of your time as well. And also, we're going to talk about the mental side of golf, how to prepare the mind for success. We're going to have some great mental coaches on the show as well to help do that. And, of course, number seven, I take that back, there wasn't eight components, seven components. The seventh is we're going to put it all together and a nice little package and help you become a much better golfer out there. So that's what's coming up. And tonight we're going to discuss some of the key areas that most golfers miss the boat at, as I just mentioned here. We're not going to get into, as I said, the meat and potatoes yet, but we're going to give you a general idea of what to expect. The last few months on the panel, we discussed some questions that were emailed in that sort of sent into the show, but I thought we would step it up a notch and expand the panel discussions to be more specific. I've isolated it down to the steps that I've just mentioned because I believe that they hold all the key components for any golfer of any level, the building blocks to plan for success. So, gentlemen, let's begin. And, Bob, because I know that you specialize in fitness, now I want you to really just sort of touch, if you will, just sort of broad strokes on some of the things that we need to be able to understand to play better golf from a fitness perspective.
Well, I think, you know, since really this stuff came out in 2006, I think golfers are realizing that, you know, it's their own bodies that are holding them back from playing better golf. And there's a realization now that, yeah, the equipment is getting better. And, you know, obviously you want to take the skill spoke of the wheel and hook up with a teaching professional so that they can help you get into those good hitting positions. But if you physically can't do that because, you know, the anatomy has some deficiencies in it, like tight muscles and weak muscles and muscle imbalances, then it kind of goes for naught. So it's become, you know, a real collaboration between the physical and the skill spokes of the wheel and all the other stuff that you talked about, nutrition and equipment and mental aspect. And, you know, it's really making a huge impact. So, yeah, I mean, golfers need to realize that they do have deficiencies. I mean, I've tested hundreds of golfers over the years, and I have yet to get somebody to go through the 11 assessments and pass every single one. And that's, you know, juniors up through tour players. So, and usually it's more, you know, in the ballpark of four or five deficiencies. So once you identify what deficiencies are, then you can target an exercise program to correct those deficiencies. And once you do, your body's going to move more efficiently and you're going to be able to get into those good hitting positions.
Right, and that's something that I really want to talk, and Bob, that's why I really want to have you part of this series, because I know that you're a fitness expert and you've studied and hold a number of certifications for that, and I really want to get your input, because I want people to understand the importance of that. I mean, you know, it's not just a matter of going to the gym and lifting a little bit of weight and doing some stretches and things like that. There's really some key things that, you know, that are specific, golf-specific, if you will, that are going to help the golf game. I mean, you don't want people going out there and bulking up like Schwarzenegger did and you know, be this big, burly, you know, husky guy, because that's not really going to be conducive to a good golf swing. Not to say that, you know, a power lifter or weightlifter can't play golf, but it obviously it presents its own, you know, unique challenges if your pecs and so forth are oversized. But so there's some real areas I want to break down as we get into that fitness for golf program, or component rather, and I would really love to have you as part of that. So we're going to get into that more in a little bit. But one of the other things that I want to do also is, you know, in the nutrition end, and I'm going to have some people I know, Bob, that you've done a lot of things on your website that talk about nutrition as well. We're going to get yourself included in that, but also we're going to get some others that specialize in nutrition as well and get some good discussion, because I think it's important what you're putting into your body and how you treat that vessel, if you will, is going to be good in all aspects of life, but particularly if you want to become a better golfer, what you eat and drink is certainly going to help. Would you agree with that?
Bob, oh, definitely. If you are what you eat, and yeah, it will make a big difference not only in your workouts, but like you say, out on the golf course.
Well, you know, people don't realize this, and, you know, when you're playing 18 holes of golf, you know, and some might argue and say, well, if you're in a cart, it's a little bit different. And, of course, it is, as opposed to walking. And a lot of people, you know, especially down here in the South, as we all are, a lot of the courses, of course, you're on a cart. But, you know, there still is a certain amount of stamina involved. I mean, you're out there, you're playing, you're in this heat quite often. And having good nutrition, you know, a lot of times when the cart girl comes around, everybody's thinking about the 19th hole and they want to put a few beers down, and there's nothing wrong with that, but you got to keep in mind, in the middle of the summer when it's 95 degrees out and humidity's at 90 to 100%, that's not always the smart thing to do if you want to play a good round of golf. So, you know, there's that component as well, and equipment and instruction. And Mike, I want to get you to jump in here as well real quick if we can, and then we're going to move on to the other segment. But, you know, obviously equipment is important. We want to be able to, you know, talk just briefly, if you can, again, broad strokes about the equipment and how important it is from the point of purchase to being properly fitted.
Was that directed toward me?
Yes, Mike, I'm sorry, yes.
Okay, yeah, yes, no worries. I was kind of enjoying listening to you all talk about the fitness program. I think I might have picked up one of your brochures, Bob. I was just up playing in the Carolinas Open at Bryant Park up there in Greensboro. Not sure, but it seems like I remember seeing something about Golf Fit Carolina. Anyway, the fitness thing is hugely important, and I'm anxious to hear you all talk more about that. But in terms of our equipment, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot in the R3 approach, is it's just an assemblage of information, you know, about playing and improving at the game of golf. And the book that we have is called Solid Contact Golf, the R3 Approach, the Anatomy of Playing and Improving at the Game of Golf. Started out kind of as a fun project, and it just kept going, and we now have put together this R3 Approach, and it genuinely talks about the approach that we as golfers use in order to genuinely improve at the game. And when we talk about genuinely improving, you know, there are aspects related to getting genuine improvement that folks, I don't think, totally grasp. And obviously, fitness and nutrition is one of them. And then we refer to it as blending different perspectives together. One of them would be the mechanical perspective. That's going to have to do with their golf clubs. One is the physical perspective. It has to do with our body. And the fourth perspective in the approach is the tactical perspective, which has to do with our brain. So blending these different perspectives together is how we genuinely improve at the game. And I think you're right on point, Ted, with kind of breaking this thing down into the different categories. It's much the same as what we've done in the R3 approach, you know, broken things down. And we actually created an R3 blending puzzle, which presents for the golfer different characteristic traits all that we all possess that all need to be addressed. As far as equipment goes, that's a tough one. I mean, it really is. You know, other than having the ability to genuinely hit different golf clubs out on a practice tee and watch ball flight, trying to find the right fit for as far as our golf club goes, golf clubs that we play with. That's tough. That's a tough one. And if we have a chance to go to a demo day or demo different clubs, that's the best way to do it. But it's kind of a process more than it is anything else. So, you know, once we can get into the right ballpark, you know, the right general shaft flex, we can determine the right lie for our irons and whatnot. But, you know, beyond that, it becomes just what does the club look like to us? What does it sound like when we hit it? And those sort of intuitive aspects of what the club is going to point us in a direction, you know.
Right, and let me just, you know, add in here if I can real quick, guys, and before we move on. You know, one of the problems I think with equipment is, and the reason why I think it's important to talk about it in certainly greater length, is I think the majority of people, when they're making a purchase, you know, for instance, let me give you an example. When you go out and you buy a car, the first thing you do is you look at the car, you like the looks and the style of the car. You obviously are concerned with the performance and obviously, you know, the reliability and so forth. You put a lot of thought and process. Now, obviously, you know, you're talking in many cases might be a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 vehicle. It's going to take a lot more time than a set of golf clubs. But having said that, a set of golf clubs is also important to have if you want to play good golf. And just to simply buy, you know, something off the rack, now, if you're playing once in a blue moon, that might be fine. But if you want to play a regular golf and you want to be consistent, you really do need to go through a proper fitting process. And there's a couple things that you – and we're going to get into this more in detail at a later date. But, you know, some of the things that we have to consider is, again, number one is a visual. You want to make sure that it fits your eye, that the particular club that you're looking at or clubs that you're looking at are something that are appealing to you, because we're all human. We all have different looks and ways of assessing what looks good to us. We do that in human nature every day. But also, once we've sort of sized it up for its appeal in a visual sense, then we need to make sure that we're comfortable hitting it, as you said, Mike, that, you know, it's hitting the way we want, it's making the sounds that are comfortable to us, and then we need to go through a proper fitting process. And the reason why I think we need to do that, there's a lot of people that don't take the proper time in getting the equipment, and what ultimately ends up happening is they're playing with something that's off the rack. It's not fitted to their game or style of play, and they're not hitting good, consistent shots. And before they get into all this instruction, I think that's really something that they need to have is a proper assessment done and be fitted properly for the equipment, and make sure that when they're purchasing that equipment that they've had all these components put together in place before they do that. So we're going to get into that a little bit more, but I'm glad that you touched on that. And obviously, of course, the instruction, that sort of speaks for itself, but we're going to talk about not just the different types of instruction, but also I want to get into more talking about how to find the right teacher. And we've talked about that before on others, but we're going to get a little bit more specific, what some people need, some questions that they need to be asking, because not every instructor is going to fit every player. As we all know in the business. And also, I think one of the things, and I didn't want to put this number one, even though it's down at number five, is practice. A lot of people out there want to become better players. They want to be more consistent golfers, but they're not willing to put in the practice, whether it be just because it's boring or maybe they just don't feel they have the time. We're going to help them build an effective workstation and put together some effective practice techniques and do it in a timely fashion that they're going to be able to get the biggest bang for their buck, so to speak. And then, of course, we're going to tackle the mental side. Guys, do you want to – any other thoughts you want to add there, and then before we move on?
That sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, ahead, Mike.
I was just saying it sounds good.
You were talking about equipment and buying clubs off the rack. I've run into quite a few golfers over the years, you know, especially the taller ones, that when they stand at address over the ball with the, you know, store-bought clubs, they tend to be – it tends to put them into a bowed spine posture, you know, a seat posture, because of the fact that the clubs just aren't long enough for them. So, I mean, that's one thing, too, especially if you're a taller golfer out there, that you need to consider, because it will kind of get you in a bad setup position, and that's just going to mess up your swing.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking as a 6'4" player, I can attest to that. And see, here's the difference too. This is something that you know, as instructors, we also have to guard against. You can put two people together the same height, but they don't necessarily are going to play the same length of club or the same lie. And here's why. Even though I'm 6'4", most of my length is in my legs. I have a shorter torso compared to maybe others that might be 6'4". Some might have a longer torso. That makes a difference because I'm going to stand a little bit higher up. My posture is going to be a little bit different than maybe somebody else at 6'4". So there's a lot of factors and components. And the reason why, guys, I wanted to break this down for these future shows is there's a lot of areas that I think that people are missing the boat on, and I think this is going to be a great way that we as instructors and coaches can come together and really break it down and help people with their golf game rather than just sort of answering, you know, some run-of-the-mill questions. And not that I don't enjoy doing that, but I think we need to give them a little more meat and potatoes, and the best way to do that is to break it down into these seven components that I believe are crucial to making better golfers out there. So having said that, if there are any other comments, guys, that you want to throw in there, we'll get on to some helping some players out there if we can.
That's very good.
All right,
let's go.
Okay. All right, let's go. All right, one of the things that there's really been defined by a lot of tour pros and even teacher professionals, really some common mistakes in golf, and I'm going to hit sort of five different areas. We may not be able to get through all of them. We'll try and see. But here's something just to let me read very quickly here. Touring professionals are often asked, what are the most common mistakes that you see your amateur partners make in pro-ams? And usually the professionals will limit maybe to one or two things. But, you know, as they're more focused, but obviously as teach professionals knows in the teaching end, we tend to see more. Now, here's some common mistakes. I'm going to do them in category in driving. Number one in driving is using a driver when you shouldn't. Swing too hard is number two, and wrong driver specs. I'm going to tackle the first one, of course, using a driver when you shouldn't. Mike, I'm going to let you start on this, and then I'm going to actually add Bob in here for a little bit of a fitness component as well in here, just to add a little extra flavor. But, Mike, there's obviously times when we're playing, and just give me an example here, that even though you're playing on par 4, par 5, sometimes driver's not always the best stick to pull out of your bag. Explain a little bit why and what should they be doing instead when they're coming up to a tee and assessing the hole that they're going to play. What factors should decide whether or not they're going to pull their driver out or not or use a different club? Mike,
sure,
that's for you.
Sure, just, it definitely falls within that tactical perspective that I was pointing toward earlier. You know, when we play, golf is very much like a chess game, so to speak. You know, the move that we make now is going to set up the next move. So when we're looking at a hole, we need to have a plan as to how we're going to most effectively play that hole. Well, based on the width of the fairway, where the dog leg, might occur, what the best side of the fairway is to be on, quite often these kinds of things a more experienced player is just going to have an intuitive sense or a feel for that shot. You know, when we talk about feel, we're talking about having just a good intuitive understanding of what the shot that we're playing is calling for us to do with the golf club. So quite often golfers will just, because it's a tee shot, they'll pull the driver out without having any feel for what they're trying to do. You know, they just expect that the driver's the club I'm supposed to be using, when in fact, you know, it might be a shorter hole. And quite often, you know, if it's a shorter hole and we want to lay up to a particular distance, we might want to, back off. And plus, the fact that the driver is typically the toughest, most difficult club we've got in terms of control and direction. And direction is what it's all about off the tee. We stress that to folks. As we get closer to the hole, distance becomes a more important factor than direction. But We can play a 200-yard shot, a 250-yard shot, or a 300-yard tee shot. All three are still in play. So, and it may be the 200-yard shot is in play, where the 300-yard shot might be out of bounds over there. So, the direction that we're looking at is very important in terms of the feel for what we're doing. So, we
Right.
Quite often, Ted, we'll spend time on the golf course with folks when we can, playing holes, just to see how they are going about the decision-making process in terms of what to be using on different holes. So it's real important to just to see that hole and understand how it is that we're going to play it, and then make a decision as to whether the driver's the best club.
Right, and a great answer, and that's exactly it. And obviously, you know, there's situations, one of the other things, obviously if it's a tight par four as an example, that maybe can easily be reached in two shots, less than a driver off the tee, a better player is going to use maybe a three-wood or even a hybrid, again, getting it in position as opposed to running the wrist and swinging for the wind. Now, Bob, I want to get you on here on the second aspect, swinging too hard, and the reason why I want to talk about the fitness end on here is fitness plays a key role on how the golf swing is applied. And let me just sort of set you up, and then you can go from there. Obviously, if we're not in good physical shape, a lot of times there isn't a sort of a rhythmic swing attached. We tend to swing for the hills because our body's tight, and in order to release that tension, we're swinging like a madman or an axe chopper. And a lot of times it's not a fluid swing like you often see the pros do. So from a physical standpoint, what are some things that golfers can do to sort of alleviate some of that tension, alleviate some of that tightness in their bodies, and maybe be a little bit more fluid with their drivers?
Well, I mean, you're going against, the golfer's egos out there. Distance is king. And so, I mean, you want to be the furthest down the fairway out of your foursome, but oftentimes, like was saying, it comes down to course management, and I know a lot of times when I play, like, in a captain's choice, and everybody's bombing the ball off the tee, and then all of a sudden you're faced with a second shot that's 50, 60 yards out that nobody has the club for. So
right.
You're better off, using the shorter club and hitting to a distance that you're comfortable with. I think I was reading an article the other day about, the grip and, the golf swing really 75-80%. If we can kind of get that into our noggins that it's not a grip it and rip it type thing, that you really kind of want to get up there and think, 75% of your max effort in the swing, you're actually going to make better ball contact and the ball will actually go further than kind of juicing it up and putting a little more mustard into the swing. That's usually when you get into the trouble and ball flight tends to be not what you want. But, grip strength has a lot to do with that as well. And that's one area that is not addressed all that much. I mean, you still have to hold on to the club because you do generate some pretty good force as you're bringing the club down through the downswing. So one of the areas that I usually generally work with my golfers is to eventually include exercises for the forearm, for the forearm flexors and extensors on the bottom and the top, respectively. But two muscle groups that are often neglected are the muscles on the side of the forearm, the adductors and the abductors, ABD and ADD. It's primarily the muscle groups you're going to use as you're kind of going through the wrist hinge and trying to hold the wrist hinge as you come down through the the hitting zone. But and that being one of the power moves in golf, the others with the shoulder turn and the initiation of the downswing with the hips. So, yeah, it does come down to mechanics, proper mechanics, and oftentimes that can be interrupted by physical deficiencies that you have. There is a strong correlation between the two. So, again, if you can fix and get into and work with a teaching professional like Mike to get you into those better hitting positions, you won't have to overswing to get the ball down the fairway.
Right, and that's so true, and some great advice there, Bob. Thank you for that input, and I think there's a lot of things that that really go into being a good driver, and one of the things obviously is a lot of amateurs make this mistake of having the wrong driver specs, and as an example, having too little loft or too stiff of a shaft are common errors that many golfers make. And really, to be honest, with the myriad of driver options out there, we're all familiar with them because we're bombarded by them every day. There's really no excuse for a player these days to have the wrong driver in his or her hand. And so that's an important component. That goes to what I was talking about earlier in some of the seven components of my new plan for success series that I want to talk about on here is about equipment. It's having the right equipment in your hand. That's certainly not going to guarantee you success all the time, but it's just one more niche, if you will, in being a better player is if you've got the right equipment. It's like digging a ditch. If you're digging a ditch, if I hand you a shovel, you're going to be more successful. If I hand you a spoon, it's going to take you a lot longer. Obviously, ultimately, if I can give you a backhoe, you're going to dig that ditch a lot faster. So we want to try and get you somewhere between the shovel and the backhoe, the backhoe being the professional level, having everything finely tuned for his or her game, and the shovel, of course, for your amateur golfers, we want to give them somewhat. So that's sort of my analogy, if you will, for that. Guys, let's move on to the iron. Iron play here is another common area that many golfers suffer with. And Mike, I'm going to come back with you. One area, of course, is not using enough club. The other one is trying to help the ball in the air. And, of course, as they put it here, shooting for sucker pins. We'll talk about that one as well. But Mike, I want you to start with not using enough club. One of the big things that a lot of the pros and teach professionals see is a lot of amateurs, when they're hitting the ball, very seldom ever hit the ball over the green. They're usually short in most cases. Talk a little bit about why that is and what are some common errors in iron play that you see with some of your students.
Right. Well, first thing, as far as not using enough club, it gets back to what Bob mentioned, alluded to earlier with the golfers' egos. I mean, everyone tends to think that they hit it a little farther than, they actually do. Myself included, probably. The carry distance is really the thing to watch for. I mean, to carry, and that's what's most important with our irons, is how far are we actually carrying the ball. And once we do determine that carry distance, how quickly are we getting it to stop? So I don't know. With the irons, and that gets into the golf swing a little bit in terms of having the right kind of swing action, the right kind of mechanics working so that we're using the club close to the way in which it was designed to be used, getting the right kind of angle of attack coming down into the ball, the right kind of compression. And that's probably one of the most difficult things for beginners and maybe juniors or someone coming along that doesn't have a lot of body strength yet, doesn't have a lot of golf strength yet, is understanding what compressing a ball with an iron really is all about. So just with the irons, the first thing we want to do is just have them understand how the club is designed to be used in terms of the angle and that we form between our arms and the shaft of the club, how that angle is moved through the swing path, which is very important in terms of direction, and then ultimately how that angle is going to be released down there through the 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock impact zone. So just getting them to understand, how the golf club, as in terms of it being a tool, is intended to be used is really important. Too many golfers just, especially your higher handicappers, when they practice, and this gets into your segment on effective practice, too many golfers, when they're on the practice tee, they're just kind of, ripping away at it, Ted, not really working on any kind of technique. They're just trying to get the best result. And too often that best result is how far can I hit it, not necessarily developing a feel for that iron in terms of controlling distance and trajectory, So I think, effective practicing with purpose, especially with our irons, speaks to developing or having the purpose and the intent of developing a feel for that iron. I mean, we might be able to take rip it out there 170 yards, but you're much better off developing a feel for that 7-iron, maybe hitting it 140 yards or 150 yards. That's what we do with a lot of our, a lot of our developing players. We'll ask them to three different trajectories, low, stock, and high, and then try to get them to hit them different distances, three-quarter, full, and then a little bit, a little stronger shot. So developing a feel with the iron is hugely important in terms of, you know, genuinely improving, not just getting out there and ripping away at it to see how far, you know, one can hit it.
Well, you're right. And also, too, Mike, I think one of the other things that a lot of people don't factor in, and I'll give you an example, you know, a lot of amateur golfers will go out to the range and they'll hit their various clubs and record the distances they're hitting each club, but then they don't factor in conditions on the course. And an example,
right.
We'll take the 7-iron. Let's say on average they're hitting their 7-iron 150 yards, we'll say. Well, that might be fine in good conditions, relatively flat section of the fairway. But if you're playing, let's say, to an elevated green and
right.
and so forth, again, that 150 yards mm-hmm. is not going to be the same as if you were playing on a flat. Conversely, if you're on an elevated level and you're hitting down to a green, you might want to use an 8-iron, get the same distance because you're
right.
going to have more time in the air and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of factors, and people just assume, I think a lot of, especially high handicap golfers, just assume. The pros obviously have gotten that down for the most part, but your high handicappers tend to think just because I hit my certain club a certain distance, it's going to be good for any time I come across that distance. Well, that's not the case.
Right.
Sometimes there's wind conditions that factor in and so on and so forth. So this is where the mental side of the game is crucial because,
yeah.
you know, you have to be able to understand. It's great that you know how far you hit each ball and how or each club, but you also have to understand when conditions change, where you have to make adjustments in your game in order to adapt to it, and that's where I think a lot of people fall short. So, great answer, Mike, as well. Bob, I'm certainly not going to leave you out of this. One of the areas that they talk about in iron play, of course, is trying to help get the ball in the air, and I think one of the problems is that a lot of people, again, going back to the fitness end of it, just don't have one, the coordination, but also just are not golf strong or golf ready, if you will, and need to work on certain aspects of their game and their fitness regime, if you will, in order to do that. And one of the reasons why people tend to help it in the air is they're not able to follow through properly on the ball because their muscles just can't support the golf swing the way it should, especially senior players and young junior players. So, again, how do we correct that? How do we help some of the golfers out there so that they're not sort of and letting the natural flow of the golf swing help, and of course the loft of the club, do the job for them?
Well, there's two common physical deficiencies that golfers have. One is a lack of range of motion in the shoulder, specifically external mm-hmm. shoulder rotation, being able to rotate the arm back if you were giving the Boy Scout sign, for instance. The second is a tightness in the mid-back area or thoracic spine area. And that's just because, you know, we're sitting a lot during the day. We're not really doing a whole lot of stretching and stuff. So either one of those individually can cause a swing fault known as reverse spine, which is very common
yep.
Today. And you can see it. I mean, you can actually see it with the naked eye. When you're playing with somebody, what happens is when they stand at address over the ball, because they're trail arm or right arm on a right-handed golfer, for instance, is lower on the club, what happens is the spine angle leans away from the target, and that's called your secondary spine angle. In the backswing, you want to be able to maintain that angle away from the target so that you're set up at the top of the backswing to initiate the downswing in the proper hitting sequence. For many golfers, because of lack of range of motion in the shoulder or in the back, they can only bring the club back so far, but they want to get the club back further. So what happens is they get pulled into reverse spine where their spine angle now leans back towards the target. Now, when you get into reverse spine, more than likely your upper body is going to control the downswing. And when that does, you also are going to have a tendency to cast out the club too early in the downswing. And what that does is it adds loft to the club, so that your trajectory
yep.
is going to be higher versus out further. So that's a big reason why a lot of golfers, you know, especially as we get older, you know, we don't really focus on range of motion and flexibility. A lot of reasons why the older golfers complain that they're not getting the distance that they once did get And a lot of that is because a lot of them go into this reverse spine, and that's due to the fact that they have lack of range of motion in those two key areas.
Right, and
Ted, can I jump in here and ask Bob a question?
Yes, you certainly. Yep.
Yeah, hey, Ted, Bob, let me ask you this. It's almost, I was very interested in what you were having to say there. This question to you would almost be the opposite side of the spectrum there. Let's take a tournament-level player. I was actually watching a video. It was about Louis Oosthuizen, about a little bit of a back, sore back, back injury that he sustained here, I don't know, maybe a year or so ago. But that, what they were talking about here was the fact that he was actually changing his spine angle on through swing, dropping in behind it too much, which is kind of a common problem for a stronger player, a better player, where they're shallowing that swing out, and they'll tend to create that secondary spine, you know, kind of get in behind it and change that spine angle on the downswing. And they were saying that this was actually creating back problems for Louis. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, that type of posture, when you do change your spine angle where you do start changing it, leaning towards back towards the target, it does put a lot of pressure on a right-handed golfer. It'll put a lot more pressure on the lower right-hand side just because of the torque that you generate and the angle that you're coming down through the downswing. It is one of the bigger, one of the two major risk factors or swing faults, I should say, that do lead up to low back injury and discomfort. And I'm sure there's probably some other issues, too, you know, that could contribute to back injuries. I mean, it is number one in golf. Tightness in the hamstrings, the muscles in the back of the thighs is in itself a major risk factor for low back injury, and that tends to occur more in men. Tightness in the hip flexors, the muscles in the front part of the hip, also by themselves can lead to low back injury, and that tends to happen more in women. So, I mean, you know, without really assessing the golfer to determine where the deficiencies are, you really can't say, but there are some generalities, and, you know, those physical deficiencies along with or independently of the swing mechanics that might be, faulty can really do a job on the back.
Right, right. You're not relating to any of this, are you, Ted? You don't have any sore backs or anything, do you?
No, I'm actually... I'm actually okay this week, so I'm good to go. But no, it's a great thing. And this is one of the reasons why I enjoy having Bob on, because, you know, the fitness side of it is just – in this day and age, you know, 30 years ago, you know, in the golf industry was a lot different. People weren't – not saying that people weren't healthy to some degree, but, we weren't as fitness conscious as we've become in the last few decades. And I think it's important that, you know, even people just don't really understand. When you look at players like Tiger and some of the others, the injuries that they've gotten, and you look at the physical shape that he's in and has been for his career, there's just a tremendous amount of torque in the golf swing at the high level especially. And even at the amateurs level, if you're not careful, you can do some serious injury. And, this is why fitness is so important to it. So great question, Mike. I'm glad that you jumped in there and did that. That's a fantastic way to help get some more information out to our listeners. The other thing I want to do just real quickly here. Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
You know, the other part of that, too, golf in itself, the action of swinging the golf club is going to create deficiencies in the body because it's a one-sided repetitive activity. So unless you kind of check, every once in a while for imbalances in the body, they'll sneak up on you and they'll start doing a job on you, and especially these younger players who have been playing for many years, you're starting to hear about all these injuries popping up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Let me just throw in here the last thing on iron play, guys, and then we're gonna move on here. you know, shooting for what we termed as shooting for sucker pins or going for the flag all the time, that's another common thing that, you know, we often see, especially at the amateur level. Certainly the pros do it from time to time, but more often than not, their percentage of greens and regulations is considerably higher than the average high handicapper, so they can certainly afford to do it. But, you know, sometimes I think that what happens is, you know, a lot of golfers out there, you know, they think that they're, again, 150 yards away and they hit a pretty decent iron, that they're always going to go for it. And sometimes going for the pin is not always the smart move. Sometimes hitting for the fat of the green is the better move. You know, sometimes you're in a situation you might have to go for it, depending if you're playing in a tournament and you're getting near the end of the tournament and you want to, you know, have a chance of either winning it or, you know, finishing high. Sometimes you need to go for that. But then there's other times you need to protect yourself and be a little bit less, you know, a little less aggressive. So, you know, and that's a pretty standard one. I think that's a common one. We all are guilty at times of doing that. We want to throw shots and get it nice and close and tight to the pin, but and for that little birdie putt or even an eagle putt in some cases. But sometimes that's not always the smart play to shoot for the pin all the time. Guys, I want to move on to pitching, and I'm going to sort of lump pitching and chipping in here together just because of the time. And Bob, I'm going to go back to you this time first. One of the common areas in pitching is little or no turning of the body. You know, since pitch shot is really a mini swing, turning of the body should not be neglected, and players need to take a club back properly and not forget to turn the body. I think one of the common things in Bob, I want you to expand on this or correct me if I'm wrong, but again, this tension sort of creeps up in the body, even on pitch shots. A lot of times with tight muscles and things like that, people just don't move as fluid as they should. So a lot of times they'll take the club back in a jerky kind of motion, and again they decelerate on some of these pitch shots because they're afraid that if they, you know, if they try to take a full or three-quarter swing through, but often, you know, instructors like Dave Pelz talks about that they're going to hit it a mile past their target. Obviously there's a fitness component here. Talk about that if you can. One of the areas that that people have is not turning the body properly in pitch shots.
Yeah, you know, and I think, too, the shorter shots, you know, there's a lot of balance issues there, you know, to be able to kind of change your posture a little bit and to kind of only have to bring the club back to, say, a 3 o'clock position, I think is a tough thing for a lot of golfers. They don't have the control to do that, but, again, I think a lot of it is the fact that, you know, you may be shifting your weight to one side versus the other. And balance also is one issue that, you know, prerequisite that we see is lacking in a lot of golfers, and not just the older golfers. You see a lot of that in the younger golfers as well. But, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of grip strength, you know, and it kind of almost sounds counterintuitive because, again, you know, you don't want to choke the club itself, but you want to be able to kind of maintain a decent grip on there while you are kind of shortening your swing and then kind of exploding down through the ball. And yes,
right,
you know, the sequence of the swing is also important. And again, you know, a lot of times we see golfers, you know, with tight internal hip rotators, you know, that are responsible for, you know, freedom of movement in the hip, along with those hamstrings and hip flexors that we talked about. So they don't have that freedom of movement to do what they need to do to really make a good shot.
Right. And you know, it's you see it so much, obviously, at an amateur level than you do. Even the pros, of course, run into problems. But I think what happens, you know, a lot of times when we're watching some of the pros on TV, especially the high handicappers, they're looking at it and thinking, okay, well, this is what I've got to do. But they're not in the same shape in a lot of cases as some of these young guys, especially coming out now. And they don't, you know, realize that, you know, these guys are pulling off shots that a lot of times they're in great physical shape. They're able to do it and look effortless when they're doing it. And the reason why is because they are in good shape. Their body has been conditioned in such a way that are toned and whatnot in a certain way, and allows them the flexibility. And the average golfer out there that I see on the range, I roll my eyes back in my head a lot of times when I see these guys trying to do some of the things that they're seeing on TV. It's just not going to happen, and especially when they're, you know, hoisting up a keg in the front, if you know what I mean. So, you know, you know, do you know what I'm saying? Mike, I want to get you to jump in here if I can. And what I'm going to do on this part here is we're going to switch over to chipping real quick. Big common mistake, a couple of areas really, is using the wrong club. A lot of times people feel that they stick with their sand wedge in a lot of cases when they're hitting chips, and that might be fine when they're really close to the green, but when they're a little further back and they might need to use maybe a mid-iron. And also a common mistake is falling back. Many golfers tend to lean or fall back in the effort to help get the ball in the air. Talk a little bit about both of those, if you will, real quickly, and then we'll finish up with a little bit of putting.
Sure, yeah. Blending technique with the physical application of that technique is kind of where this is all going. With our short game, whether it's pitching the ball, chipping the ball, the pitch shot, it involves we have to create the angular momentum. We have to set the angle, and then in a good pitch shot technique, what we're going to do is actually release our body, as you were pointing out. You know, we're going to turn and release our body while holding off that angle. So it's referred to as I think Phil Mickelson described it in his stuff as the hinge and hold technique. Well, that's exactly what it is.
Yep.
When we're setting up to hit a pitch shot, we'll set that angle, and then most of our weight will stay over there on our left side if we're a right-handed player, and then we'll release our body through while holding off that angle. Too many times the technique side of it gets a little confused because folks are thinking that they have to do so much more than is necessary. They'll have too long an arm swing, which sets them up for the need to decelerate, actually. So what we see a lot is just folks don't understand that, how the hinge and hold technique truly works, what it's all about, and how we need to utilize that angular momentum by keeping our arm swing short and just setting a little angle with our wrist and then releasing our body through. And Bob was pointing out the fact that, there may be some physical deficiencies there that are contributing to a person's inability to keep that balance condition, keep that weight kind of on the left side so we can pivot through and just release our bodies nicely without flipping the club. And then the chipping aspect, it's, there's not as much angular momentum going on there. That's kind of where we're beginning to consider using different clubs. It's getting closer to putting, as we move into the chipping technique, it's getting closer to the putting technique where there's really no body movement. There's really no angular momentum going on, very little angular momentum going on. It's a very quiet movement there. And again, any excessive movement is just counterproductive. We talk about the need to continue subtracting. We're always talking to folks about it's the fifth law in the R3 approach, actually. It's called subtraction. And, whether it's our emotional amps that we have running, that needs to be subtract, or our physical movements we need to subtract unnecessary movement out of our technique whenever possible. And just understanding the best basic technique involved with these different strokes or shots is really important. And then, of course, having the physical capabilities to make these movements is just makes one's ability to hit these shots just that much better.
Exactly. And I couldn't have said it better myself. Guys, the thing is really that there's – what people don't understand about golf is there's both the physical – and I'm referring to the shape somebody's in and the physical fitness level that somebody's at. And obviously there's mechanics as well that are involved. But a lot of people don't understand that they go hand in hand, and putting is a great example. A lot of people don't think you have to be all that physically fit really to be an effective putter, but that's not entirely true. Now, it doesn't mean you can't play or you can't putt, but let me give you an example. A lot of posture is used when you're addressing the ball in a putting stroke, and if you've got weak muscles, especially in your core, you're going to adopt, as Bob alluded to earlier, with talking about height differences and stuff. Having the right equipment makes a big difference, of course. That helps you a little bit. But if you've got poor posture, a lot of times you're not going to make a great putting stroke. So, Bob, I want to talk a little bit about how the posture in the putting stroke, if it's not right, how that can affect it. And then I've got a couple things, Mike, I'm going to get you to close out that segment.
Okay.
Well, I think, with putting, everybody's going to go to the tabletop posture now, given the success. Michelle Wee had this past weekend at Pinehurst. And, boy, I look at that and I just cringe. And just going to wonder what her back's going to be like in another few years if she maintains that posture. But it works for her, so, you know, and that's what golf's all about. You know, you stay with what works for you. But you're right, you know, when you're standing over the ball, and some people tend to stand over the ball quite a lengthy time as they're lining up their putts, I mean, you're kind of in that half-bent-over posture. So, yeah, your core needs to be nice and strong, especially lower back. Lower back strength is going to be essential to maintain that posture, you know, for the length of time while you're trying to remain steady as you swing the arms back and forth, you know, in that kind of triangle movement. So really the big area that you, you know, you really want to focus on is lower back strengthening and hamstring flexibility, because hamstrings allow that hip bone to rotate as you do bend forward. And if the hamstrings are tight as you lean forward over the ball to line up the putt, you know, that hip bone may not rotate as much as you want it to because of the tight hamstrings. And so in order for you to continue to lean forward, the low back muscles have to get stretched out, and that can lead to a strain of the lower back. So hamstring flexibility and low back strength are key in the putting stance.
Yep, well said. And thank you, Bob, for your feedback and for your thoughts on that this evening. I appreciate that. Mike, I want you to just close out real quickly here with putting. There's a couple of things, obviously, that people lack. Some people tend to almost flick with their dominant hand on putting. Obviously, a lot of us underread the break in many cases. And obviously, a big one is lack of distance control. So just touch very briefly, if you can, just, again, some broad strokes. I know you can't get into all the specifics. Just a little bit in those areas, if you can, on putting.
Sure. Yeah, when we work with folks in terms of their putting, we stress the fact that again, distance is important aspect of being a good putter. The objective when we're on the putting green is to two putt. I mean, if we can knock one in, that's wonderful. But you know, the objective is to two putt, and to two putt requires a good sensitivity for distance. And again, it gets into kind of a feel thing, you know, an intuitive sense for how this green is going to roll out, the speed of the green, the firmness of the grain. A lot of factors will play into it. But just doing different kinds of drills, you know, Ted, that help us to enhance our feel for distance control is hugely important. One of the things that we do that's kind of interesting, we'll put a stripe around a golf ball just to see how well an individual is able to get that ball rolling as it comes off the putter, and that immediately points toward their technique. But when we can roll that ball better, when we can get that ball rolling quicker instead of it skipping or hopping before it starts rolling, it allows a person to really begin to develop that sensitivity for distance control so much quicker. So many times, and when we've done this with folks, it's pretty interesting. Normally, the only thing required is to get the handle of the putter a little further forward. Put the putter in a good position at impact will get the ball rolling sooner and get it rolling quicker. And once we get that ball rolling quicker like that, it sets us up to begin to develop that intuition for, you know, pace and controlling the speed of that putt. But so important to develop that feel for distance control. And in order to do that, what I'm saying is you really have to have a good technique. Whatever that technique may be, that putter needs to be in a good position when it contacts that ball relative to the face. Sometimes we'll change the loft on a putter for someone, and it helps them tremendously. You know, we've got a putter line off machine in there, and it may be that normally it's just a matter of having them set their hands a little more forward, put the handle of the club a little more forward, and then make their stroke immediately begins to produce a better roll. So very interesting little experiment to have. If you put a stripe around the ball completely. I noticed Jim Burek's got a stripe all the way around his ball right now, completely around the ball. And interesting enough, you can buy, I guess it's an 1¾-inch piece of PVC pipe from Lowe's at Home Depot. And a golf ball fits in an inch and three-quarter, I think that's the size, piece of PVC pipe perfectly. It hits the equator of the golf ball perfectly, and you can use one of those. And they sell plenty of those little devices where you just fit the ball in and put a line
right.
on. But I would really, really recommend that for folks to do. If you've not done it, get a marquee pen and put a stripe all the way around. The most aggravating aspect of doing that little experiment is just bending down there to the green and seeing that the stripe is set vertically to begin with. It's kind of a hazard.
Yeah, especially as especially as you get older.
Yeah, that's
right.
I'll put six of them down there while I'm down there, you know, so I don't have to keep bending.
Yeah.
But you get them, and you don't have to be aiming at a hole either. By the way, what you're interested in here is just how quickly am I getting that ball to roll, and how vertical
right.
can I keep that stripe? And it's
exactly.
amazing, Ted. I mean, you know, we'll put that ball down there for most putters, and the first few rolls they make, I mean, that stripe's all over the place. You know, it's just wobbling. And then maybe, you know, 6, 8, 10 putts later, after a few adjustments, you know, that stripe is just staying dead vertical, and the individual lights up when they see that, you know. And they should, because
mm-hmm.
they're really improving something in terms of their putting technique that's gonna benefit them, you know, to get that ball rolling like that. And as
yep.
I said, that really is the first step toward developing that intuitive sense for speed and distance control.
Exactly. Well, guys, I want to thank you for being on the panel tonight. It was a little bit different than what I've normally had in the past. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going to be up and coming for Coach's Corner. I think it's going to be a great series planned for success, and I certainly want both of you to participate in that. I'm going to be sending out an email to everybody that's been on the panels and that over the last several months to let them know exactly what's going to happen and how I want them to participate in it. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be very informative, and I've had a few people have asked me, you know, wanting to get a little more meat and potatoes, as it were, in some of the discussions. So I think this is a great way to do it and something I've wanted to do for a long time. So, guys, if you want to just very quickly just take a quick second, Bob, I'll start with you. Just let everybody know where they can find you and get a hold of you, and then Mike will let you as well, and then I got to close off the segment.
Very good.
Sure. You know, my email address, if you have any questions, is bob@golffitcarolina.com, and that's one F and one T, so it's like Golf It Carolina. If you'd like to call me, my number is 336-509-4610. To schedule a fitness screen or a training session. In the book, Functional Golf Fitness Training, it can be found online at Amazon or in print at thebookpatch.com.
Fantastic. And Mike?
Very good, very good. Yes, to contact me, you can check out MikeLawrenceGolf.com, pretty simple, or tgmgolf.com, and email address there. Got a couple of them. mike@tgmgolf.com is good. And then also mikelawrence705@gmail.com is another email that I use.
All right. Well, guys, listen, again, thank you very much for pitching in tonight. There's some great discussion, and as I said, I hope that you'll join me for some future discussions when we get ready to launch the Plan for Success series. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and I think everybody will enjoy it. So, guys, thank you very much for taking the time tonight. I know you guys are busy, and I look forward to having you back many, many more times in the future. Thanks, guys, and have a great evening.
Very good.
All right, Mike.
Thanks. Okay, Bob. See you, buddy.
All right. See you,
Ted. All right.
Ted.
Thanks, guys. Yep, thank you. Okay, I see that my guest this evening is ready to go. So let me just give you a little bit of insight. My guest, of course, this evening is special guest is John Weir. He's the author of Golfer's Guide to Mental Fitness, also the creator of The Mental Caddy and award-winning hypnotist. Very interesting. I want to talk a little bit more about that, of course, when he comes on here in a second. He's a board-certified hypnotist and certified instructor of hypnotism through the National Guild of Hypnotists. He's also the founder of the Mental Golf Academy, I believe, down in Orlando, and the Mental Golf Coach to professional and collegiate golfers from around the world. So help me welcome my guest this evening, Mr. John Weir. John,
how are you tonight? Oh, I'm doing fantastic.
I'm doing very well,
how are
John?
You?
I'm doing excellent, John. Thank you for being a guest this evening. I've been looking forward to having you on, and I know that you're excited to be on as well. So we're going to get right to it. How's that?
Sounds great.
John, one of the things that really kind of intrigued me, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the specifics, of course, about hypnosis, but also how you're sort of merging it, if you will, in the golf business. But first, what is hypnosis, and is it what we often see in the movies, or what is is there some science behind it?
Well, I tell you what, the easiest way to start to answer that question, which is people have been asking for hundreds of years, is to kind of start by saying what it's not, Ted. So many misconceptions out there about what hypnosis is based on the movies, those weird fiction books, and all these really exaggerated tales of really what this type of communication process is all about. Now, to really understand how this works, there's three main parts that we got to understand. First is every single human being has two parts of the mind, defined by science. We have a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere, also often called conscious and subconscious mind. Now, your conscious mind is what we're using right now. It's analyzing, it's judging, it's critiquing. It's using all those analytical filters. And as adults, this is the part that is our primary dominant brain. And that's why they say we use about 7 to 10% of our brain's potential. Now, on the other side, we have the subconscious. It's like a biocomputer. It stores all of our memories, all of our habits and experiences. It runs our body. And most importantly, it has our self-image. And our self-image is our concept of ourself internally that really governs our thoughts, our behaviors, and our life throughout the day. Now, we have these two parts of mind. One is critical, one is very accepting, and is the doing part. The way we want to learn is we got to get things into the subconscious mind, because that's the part of our mind that puts things into action. And people know this because how many people out there, let's say, dealing with a bad habit like smoking, they say, I want to quit smoking, and then they have that little voice come up and say, yeah, right, you've been smoking for 20 years. People step up on the tee box and they say, I want to strike this drive. That critical voice comes in and says, yeah, right, you just hit three into the trees. So that's the critical nature of our mind. On the other side, we have the childlike part of our mind, the subconscious. It doesn't discern fact or fiction. It supports whatever is given to us. And it takes it and begins to cultivate and groom it and make it into a reality. And it's the part of our mind driving our behavior. Now, the next thing that we have that science has determined about our mind that we didn't know a number of years ago is our brain waves. So we have this technique or process of EEGs, which measures the brain waves that every human being is experiencing. And scientists have determined we have four primary brain waves. Beta, again, what we're using right now, left hemisphere, very critical, analytical, logical. We have alpha brain waves, is which what we experience like when we're really relaxed as adults. We might be taking a stroll in a garden, driving our car on autopilot. I mean, Ted, how many times have you driven someplace like work or home and you don't even remember driving? You just kind of arrive. That's a form of alpha brain waves. And then we have theta, which is what we have when we're having lucid dreaming at night, when we're slipping into deep states of, you know, in the evenings when we're dreaming, we're going into those states right before going to bed. Theta waves are that state of mind we get into when we're still somewhat aware of our surroundings, but we're losing touch with, like, the feeling of the bed at night, and we're starting to slip into our own world. And then we have delta, which is unconsciousness or unconscious brain activity. Now, why this is important to know is when we're children, our primary brain waves are alpha and theta brain waves. This gives us the ability to learn super fast. If you watch little kids learning language, they're not putting conscious effort into it. They're not there looking at flashcards or trying to connect pictures or associations. Their brain is just soaking everything in as a sponge. All of the major feats of learning that we did as adults occurred when, or I mean in our lives, occurred during childhood when we're in alpha and theta brainwaves. Now, as we become adults, again, our left hemisphere starts developing, and it's there as a primary protective function. So people, as they start getting older, get less flexible and more rigid, and it's because the brain hemispheres are changing, and adults are learning, are losing touch with how they actually learn. Because we're getting away from the alpha and theta brainwaves, and we're primarily living in beta, which is critical, analytical, and judging. And then the final aspect is hypnosis isn't even a state of mind, which many people think it is. Hypnosis is a communication process. Science has showed us that people in a state of hypnosis, meditation, deep relaxation, and prayer, they all are operating in alpha and theta brainwaves. So hypnosis isn't some mystical state of mind where someone might be levitating around the room or they drift off to some alternate reality like they say in the movies and suddenly things are different or they're in lose their soul, their wallets, whatever it is. It isn't
right.
That way at all. What hypnosis is, it's a communication process that has a couple distinct purposes. First off, we use communication to relax the brain waves. When the brain waves begin to relax, what happens is the brain hemispheres come into balance. So we get out of being stuck in just analysis, and we actually start elevating the right hemisphere. MRIs show that when they're in this state of alpha and theta brainwaves, more of the brain is illuminated, and it's directed towards one specific task. So hypnosis is a communication process that relaxes the mind, and it happens simply just by following simple step-by-step instructions. When the mind is relaxed and we maintain those states, the mind is open to accelerate our learning. And that can include skill acquisition. It could be intangible qualities like confidence, focus, these types of things. And then the final aspect of hypnosis is to deliver a message that's going to help this learning process, that positive message that people have been trying to communicate to themselves for so long but have been unable to get it into the right part of the brain. And so in a nutshell, that's really what this is about. It's rooted in science, and it's psychology in action.
Right. Let me ask you, John, if I can, you know, as what I understand you're saying here is obviously the subconscious part of the mind is really, you know, is part of the development part that we've done as a child, as you said. In training that part of your mind in order to reach some of the higher levels of performance, say in the golf course, why is training that, number one, important, and how do we go about doing that?
Well, the way we go about doing that is through processes like hypnosis, and hypnosis is really the methodology that's left out of a lot of the golf psych books. And part of it's because there's millions of dollars on the lines with these high elite golfers. People don't reveal the training secrets. Other ways that we do this is through mental rehearsal, visualization, and all those common techniques. But the thing that they don't talk about is hypnosis. In the relaxed state of mind, every elite athlete gets into prior to going through those drills. Now, why it's so important to get the brain relaxed is, again, your subconscious doesn't discern the difference between fact or fiction. So by doing mental rehearsal inside of the mind, it's actually creating neural pathways in your brain and activating the same parts of your brain that occur during physical performance. And this is called shared neurocircuitry. So what ends up happening is, as you're repeating mental rehearsal of your swing visualization of outcomes, your brain is literally creating neural pathways to make that easier. The problem is most golfers are doing this anyways, but it's working in a negative direction. Most people who come off the course, they rehearse again and again and again all of their mistakes without knowing this is actually doing practice in their brain. And so what we can do is we can eliminate a lot of physical variables by doing mental training, yet still develop the parts of the brain needed to execute tasks. For example, Brain Imaging Center in San Antonio, Texas said, when we visualize, we're creating 80% of our neural pathways needed to execute a task. So if you're visualizing success, you're already 80% of the way there mentally. You're visualizing negatives, you're already 80% of the way there mentally. So the importance is of getting that drilled into the subconscious, because when we get information in there, we act on it like a kid. You tell a kid there's Santa Claus, they don't question that. They say, okay, great.
Right.
There's a guy who comes down the chimney, you know, tooth fairy. Oh, wow, I'm going to put my tooth under the bed. They take it in and they act on it. Where adults, we receive information like everybody's right now, and it's going through our filters. And so what we end up getting is, as adults, is information but not integration. And the importance of training the subconscious is so we act upon these great insights that sports psychology has put out, these ideas that we know to be true or we could do if we could only get past that mental barrier. And little do people know that it's as simple as just learning to relax the mind. And it's that simple. And as we do that, we get into those learning states. And from there, it's about putting in those positive messages. And it increases our ability to go out and act upon them.
Let me ask you, John, you know, I mentioned in the intro that you, obviously you work with a lot of not only collegiate, but obviously, you know, professional golfers worldwide. What are some of the ways that you're helping these golfers at whichever level it is, doesn't really matter, but at both levels, let's say, with hypnosis? How are you using this hypnosis, and is this something that you're doing in an office, or you're doing it at the while you're at the course with them, or how are you approaching this?
Well, I mean, there's a number of different ways that we can do it, and we do all the above. I work with people in an office over Skype. We go out to the course to work through things, as well as I even caddy for some of my elite golfers, and we're actually implementing these things out on the course in tournament settings. So hypnosis can help in a variety of ways because the mind can't be separated from performance on whatever level. And a lot of it's going to depend upon where the golfer is. Some guys come in, and ladies, they have high confidence. We don't have to work through confidence issues. Other people come in very low self-esteem, that got extraordinary talent, no belief. So it depends on where we're going. So hypnosis is effective in a number of ways. One is we can go and eliminate a lot of those limiting beliefs that are getting in the way of our success, those mental hurdles. Other people, especially a lot of the professionals I work with, they have these negative imprints from the past. So they have like that one tournament, they blew it. And now it comes up subconsciously. It holds them back. So sometimes we go and use this process to go in and identify where these memories are, these triggers of negative states, and we begin to change them and correct them. Now, we can't undo the past, but what we help people to do is find the lessons that are there that actually help them to become the golfer that they are now. Other ways that we use this is by training and conditioning to mind to have habits and mental triggers for success. I'll give an example outside of golf. You have a smoker, right? They go and they sit in the car, they light up a cigarette. They go in the car, light up a cigarette. Go in the car, light up a cigarette. It doesn't take long for the brain to link up sitting in the car, lighting up a cigarette. We accelerate this conditioning process with hypnosis. So instead of making a negative habit, what we're doing is we're recalling our best peak performances. And mentally, while we're in these states, we can relive things as if it's real. Our muscles fire. Our brains are firing. We're experiencing the emotions. And then what we do is we take one of those peak states and we'll, let's say, link it up to gripping of their club. So let's say someone's struggling off the tee. We recall all their successes as they're getting into that peak state, they grip their club. We get them back into that peak state, grip the club. Then we use post-hypnotic suggestions to help trigger those things into action. So we train then the brain through communication strategies to say, each and every time you grip that club, instantly, automatically, without thinking, your brain recalls and fires off this pattern. Now, all golfers think in pictures. These pictures are directing our performance. So by creating a natural trigger like the smoker going to the car and wanting to light up, is the same way we turn our golfers into when they step foot on the tee box, they're ready to dominate. When they grip that club, their bodies instantly relax, their mind focuses. So that's some of the ways that we do it. But there's so many different strategies and styles. It really just depends upon that person. But that's a lot of the things that we do is actually linking up success. And now we're creating triggers that are naturally unfolding on the golf course, keeping our golfers in their peak performance state. And then the other major thing is dealing with adversity. So the only really teacher that we can learn to go through that is by actually going through it. And sometimes that isn't the most comfortable experience. But what we can do in hypnosis is, again, bring up periods or times where these stressors are happening or they could foresee adversity, and we're mentally walking them through coping strategies. We're mentally walking them through handling the adversity in different ways. And what this does is it creates a connection of association and familiarity. So next time that situation occurs on the course, this is all done subconsciously, too. Just like we hit a bad shot, it's not like we're always consciously choosing that reaction. So we actually train the people to have the desired reaction that they want. And again, through hypnosis, we're able to go into those experiences, go through a trouble, but then have the ability to manipulate the situation so that our brains are getting trained with the right response to it. That's kind of some of the things.
Right. Now, you mentioned earlier on about visualization and, of course, mental rehearsal. These are some of the ways – what are some of the ways that you're using hypnosis in order to enhance the effectiveness of some of these techniques?
Well, again, it's getting back into that relaxed state of mind. So think about when we drift off to sleep or we're waking up on a Saturday morning, we get the luxury of sleeping in one day. We sometimes create very vivid imagery in our mind. When we're starting to get into hypnosis or these relaxed states of mind, and we start getting into that calm state, our imagination comes to the forefront. And our imagination is the most powerful function that we have mentally. It overrides critical thought. It creates our experience. And, you know, so often in life we get stuck taking action on things because our imagination is making things bigger than what it is. So this power of our imagination, when we can start getting it to work in our favor, which is what it does when we start relaxing and it get directed in the right way, hypnosis makes these experiences more vivid. It makes it more lifelike. And it also accelerates the process of the development of neural pathways because the information isn't going through the critiquing factor. The mind is accepting and then putting it into action. The critical analysis is suspended. Now, it doesn't mean that with the critical analysis being suspended, you're going to go and do stuff that, you know, you normally wouldn't or go against your morals because you're always aware of what's going on. We're always in control, and nobody ever gives that up. But what it is it allows us to get those positive messages there, positive pictures, and create those images of success much easier than in a conscious state or in a state where we're at right now where we're just basically analyzing.
Right. And let me also ask you this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, essentially, you know, you have some people who are dreamers, and when I talk about dreamers, I'm not referring to, you know, you dreamt about the time you were at the park, but you have people who, you know, visualize in their I guess through their subconscious what they want to do or how they see their lives unfolding, and then the filters sort of take over and prevent that. Is that essentially what you're doing? Is you're helping to bring more of the subconscious side of the brain, if you will, out in the forefront as opposed, in other words, you're taking down some of the filtering process, all of the negative and the bad thoughts that are sort of preventing that individual from realizing their potential. Is that essentially what the hypnosis
is
doing?
You absolutely said it spot on, absolutely. And here's the reason why. Again, going back to when we were kids, our brains are wide open. So during this time, our brain is collecting all this data to form our self-image. So this is what we believe to be true that other people have told us and the things that we've said to ourselves over and over and over again that we believe to be true. So it forms a self-concept of who we think we are. And what ends up happening as we become adults, if we don't – think of it like this. If you're pouring concrete out in front of your house, at first when you lay that concrete, you can move it. You can spread it. You can manipulate it however you want. But once that hardens, it becomes almost impossible to move it, right? You got to break it apart in order to make it move.
Right.
And this is kind of the way adults' mind get if we get stuck in beta frequencies. Because we have this concept of ourselves, we get older, and now we build up these analytical filters. And the way the filters base the information on is what our inner mind believes to be true about ourselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always use the cut and dry example of a smoker. A person believes themselves to be a smoker. You could tell them all the positive things in the world on why to change, but it gets hit by that filter. Why? Subconscious is believing themselves to be true as a smoker. Now, here's an interesting thing. Your subconscious will support any image. The subconscious is like the soil to the ground, and anybody who kind of understands gardening in any way can understand how this works. The subconscious is the soil. It can't discriminate. It has to support the seeds that go in it. Its job is to cultivate. Mm-hmm. Now, our conscious mind's job is to help us define our choices and hopefully come up with things that we're consistently planting that are correct. But if we don't and we're just growing up through life and our parents or people around us saying, you're a loser, you're a loser, you get to be 20 years old and you say, hey, I can go and achieve this, now we have a filter for loser. Same kid can say, I'm a winner, I'm a winner, I'm a winner. They get to be that age and they say, hey, I can do this. I believe that. That's supportive. And so you're right on. The analytical filters start going down so that we can actually update information. It's like doing a hard drive update and getting rid of kind of like the firewall and your antivirus stuff first so that we can get into the back end to update the program so that the computer has something new to support. Otherwise, it'll support good or bad. It just has to support it like the soil, whatever's in there. But then here's the problem. You know, how do we change that? And as adults, we've lost touch with how we actually learn. So it's as simple as relaxing your brain. And here's the coolest thing I tell my clients. This is the one time in your life you're ever going to get to hear this. The less that you do, the better you're going to be here in this process. So the less thought they put into it and the more they just let me walk them through the processes, the more they benefit. And we just get back into that soaking up of the material and those positive messages we've been trying to deliver for so long, but just unsuccessfully.
Well, and you know that you raise some interesting points because, you know, a lot of golfers, especially as, you know, I'm 50, I teach golf and have for a number of years, but I've also played since I'm 50 this year, so I played since I was about 7. And even I, even though I understand what you're saying, even I over time, you let some of those negative thoughts get in. I certainly have done, I think, a fairly good job of beating them down, but they still, even at the best of us, they still sort of creep in from time to time. How do you take, let's say, somebody that's played for 20 years that's been bombarding themselves with a lot of negative thoughts? What are some of the first things that you do, and how do you approach them?
That's a great question.
Sort of
I mean, the starting point for everybody, and this is even for the most confident, is becoming aware of self-talk.
John, let me just stop you for one second. Let me just take this a step further, and I'll let you. And sure. I apologize for interrupting you, but just to give you an example, you get a lot of golfers that, you know, their common response is, well, you know, I've been hitting it this way for 25 years, or I've been doing it this way for such and such time. So a lot of times golfers have already come out with the excuses. You know, I get that sometimes when teachers or when students are coming to me, and I'll say, okay, let's work on such and such. And, well, I've been kind of doing it this way, as I said, for a number of years or for 25 years. I've been hitting it the same way, and they're very reluctant to change. How do you approach, first off, not only knowing that they've got the negative, you know, thought process going on, but they're already attacking, not really attacking you, but coming to the process with sort of an excuse bucket list, if you will? Go ahead.
Sure. You know, for everybody, we start with just first the language. And at that point, I also identify, you know, a lot of my work, Ted, isn't actually what you would quote-unquote call hypnotizing somebody. A lot of it is dehypnotizing. And it's helping them to get past all these negative things that they have believed to be true about themselves and start ripping out some of these negative belief systems. So starting point sometimes is identifying what those belief systems are. You know, what are those belief systems that are governing their lives? I hit the ball for 25 years this way, so that means I have to hit it like this here on out.
Yep.
That could be a limiting belief. I had a kid who came in very angry, and he said, when I was a kid, I hypnotized him, we regressed him back to cause, when this really started. He was coming off the course, he shot, I think, like a 45 or something when he was a little kid. And he was really, really happy about it. And there was two older kids that he thought were really good golfers coming off the course. And they were really angry. And he said, well, what did you guys shoot? And it was like a 38, way better than he was. And it instantly changed his state. It formed a belief system of saying, hey, good golfers get angry if they don't do well. Good golfers slam a club if they don't hit the ball well to let everybody else know, I'm not happy with this because I'm a good golfer. Well, this also affected his recruiting for college. It was coming into play with things. And a lot of that was finding that belief system and then beginning to work through it. And a lot of times, Ted, I wish it was easier than saying, I mean, it's the easiest way to say it is we got to get them into a conducive learning state and relax the mind. Otherwise, the starting point for everybody, though, typically, and for everybody listening, it's really correcting your self-talk. Because it's the words and the things that we're saying out on the course that are actually creating these pictures. So it's not always what the words that are important, but there's negative programming words that create images in the mind that the brain acts on. For example, I mean, just be mindful of this for the next day you go out tomorrow. See how many times people say, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
Now, the word do and don't at a subconscious level, it means the same thing. Don't think of a pink elephant. Don't think of hitting a hook, you know, don't put that in the water. It immediately conjures up an image in the brain and the mind responds to the images our words create. We hear people say, if, really weak word is if I can do this, if I hit it this way. We change that to when. We get rid of the trying and the hoping. And we begin to correct and monitor their self-talk. Now, if you do this, it sounds simple and it takes discipline because people overlook their words. But in the golf, the very best people are ones who have developed that discipline. Because when we're behind the ball, if we're saying, okay, what do I don't want to hit this in the water. And now we're taking practice swings. Don't hit this in the water. We create it. What do? Step up and do that. So, for one, we get people talking about what they actually do want to do. And I know that sounds simple, but it was people listen to this throughout. Listen to people who, as over the next few days, everybody will tell you what they don't want. I don't want to do this.
Right.
I did this for 25 years, Ted. This is what I don't want to do. And, again, it's creating a picture. We step up. Pictures are guiding our motor commands, our bodies. I mean, regardless of what people think the percentage is of the mental side, you can't swing a golf club without a mental picture. Your body doesn't do that on its own. So these words become so hypercritical for us. And at first, you know, people kind of go through a little bit of torture with it because they're starting to get off autopilot. And that's really that starting point, Ted, is to say, look, you're the master of your mind. Your mind isn't in control. But you've let your kid be like a kid in that spoiled child who's got out of control. And it's going to take some time to discipline it and get it back in a line so that we can claim our rightful spot as the master of it. And that's really the starting point for any negative spot is correcting of the words, monitoring that, and also taking on responsibility for our thinking. That's one of the biggest differences from the PGA Tour pros versus the vast majority of other golfers. They take responsibility for their thoughts, and they realize there is no random thought out there. Every thought is influencing performance.
Well, and you raise a valid a point here, and let me just interject here if I can real quickly. You know, if you look back in history, not only today's PGA player and LPGA and that, but if you look at today's player right back to the beginning of when golf, you know, we first understood golf, the best players were really masters of their minds. You look at players like Nicklaus. Now, there certainly were a lot of great players that were great, but the truly great players were not necessarily the best ball strikers. Nicklaus was certainly could hit a great shot and when he needed to, but he was a master of his mind. He had such an effective mind game. Look at Tiger Woods, the same thing. Lots of people can drive the ball better and can hit better iron shots than Tiger Woods could, but his mind control has been so, you know, so focused, as well as Nicklaus and many others over the years. That's why they dominated on the tour for so many years, because of that.
That's absolutely correct.
You know, and what gets me, you know, in today's, you know, mind, if you will, with the average golfer out there, and we talked about this earlier in the program with the panel, is they're still in this mindset, well, if I can just hit the ball 300 yards, you know, I'll be able to win the tournament or I'll be able to play a little better. And that's not the case.
Sure.
You know, because and that's what I try to get across to people as well is, you know, certainly you have to have a certain skill set to play on the PGA or LPGA Tour or Champions Tour. But at the same time, if you're a master of the mental side of your game, you're going to be a far better player and far last a lot longer than you are just by simply being a good ball striker.
Well, and absolutely, because the game of golf is you're going to deal with a lot more adversity, too, than you're going to deal with success. So really the strong survive with it. And I absolutely believe here's what we talk with our young golfers coming into the program. I'm kind of under the belief that junior golf is really about technique development. This is the time when we really want to develop really solid technique. And then you want to go out and you're going to start competing and trying to get some good success as a junior so that you can get that junior goal. And the goal I see for junior golfers is get that college scholarship. Now you get to college and you got talent. Now you come to a realization everybody here has talent. So most of the time in the college game, a lot of the kids are struggling with two things. One, learning time management. And two, how to work. Because talent will only get you so far, and kids are oftentimes opened up to a rude awakening. They get to college, everybody's as good, and now everybody's working harder. So the successful college golfers, the ones who transition then, are ones who develop that really good work ethic. So now you have talent. Mm-hmm. Now you have the work ethic, and you're learning how to play the game, which is what good college coaches teach. They're teaching kids how to play, not necessarily technique. And now it becomes at that next level. It is a belief system game. it completely is a belief system game because so little is separating these guys week in and week out physically, talent-wise, equipment-wise. I mean, they're the best of the best. They got the best fitness, the best nutritionist.
Yep.
I mean, they're finely tuned athletic machines. So what is separating them? And what I've been learning over the years is, you know, there's a lot of things that people talk about, focus, confidence, all these things. I believe that those are all forms of mental energy that never leave us. The difference is,
right,
is where that energy gets directed towards when we're dealing with different adverse situations or success. So if you think of it like a pipe of water, that water is always flowing, so we're always focused. But when we're stressed, we start focusing on the wrong things. Everybody who's ever golfed in the zone, which everybody has, focus was there. You didn't go out there and say, I tried to focus more. No, it was there. You were in the moment. You were grooving it. Confidence was there. You didn't have to think about being confident. You felt it. It was there. But people, whenever they're not hitting the ball well, are also confident. But they're confident in their insecurities. They're confident in their mistakes, that they're going to happen again.
Yeah.
So I'm under the belief now that the best thing that anybody can do as far as their mental game is learn how to manage stress. And it's
yes.
all about stress management. If you look at something that's going to always be constant, especially in competitive golf, is stress and pressure. And it's who can best deal with that. And that's what makes Jack and Tiger and all these guys so special. They have learned how to better deal with that internally. Now, here's why stress is the biggest thing. When we have stress, and this can be of any kind, Ted, if an alligator came out and chased you on the course, you'd have the same stress as if you were standing over that slippery five-footer and going, oh, my gosh, can
yep.
I make this for the win? Your body
right.
responds physiologically to the same thing. So you have a release inside of your brain of cortisol, norepinephrine, and epinephrine. And cortisol is the big one. So when this cortisol release is going on physiologically, here's what's interesting. It cuts off the neocortex part of our brain. Now, what is this responsible for? For golfers, it's perception of the situation, it's decision-making, synchronistic muscle movements, coordination, and motor commands. So when we have this stress release going on in our brain, we're literally cutting off or inhibiting the part of our brain that we most need to execute a golf swing.
Right,
and what's
right.
going to happen is golfers are going to be affected in one of three ways by stress primarily. You're going to see a change in their tempo of their swing. You're going to see a change in the tension level in their body, grip pressure, and you're also going to see a change in their thinking. And it's about managing that stress. So if we can eliminate that cortisol release, we're actively going to be performing better, and we can outperform the other people who are dealing with the same stress. And here again, where hypnosis helps. So instead of having to go through a tournament and then lose it and have to go through what that felt like, we can go back and use our imagination and our subconscious mind to give us a lifelike experience of going through this. Now, I just give you an example on the positive side. A good friend of mine from out in California, she was a former LPGA player. She was saying, John, mm-hmm. it was so cool. I close my eyes. I relax myself. Do what you say. And we begin visualizing the success and the results. And she said, I went through everything. She said, I saw myself winning the event 4 under. And I ran over. My dad was going to be there. I jumped into his arms and gave him a big hug. She goes, the day of the event came. She goes, I'm coming down the 18th. She goes, I wasn't 4 under. I was 7 under. I hit my shot
wow.
just like I envisioned to about 4 feet from the hole. And she says, I made the putt, looked over, saw my dad, jumped into his arms, and I didn't even realize what I'd done. She goes, I just shot 7 under. I didn't realize I won the tournament. And
yep.
she ran over, and the dad says, you just won. Now, here's what's interesting. She said, she goes, this was blowing me away, but I talked to my dad and I said, Dad, why am I not as happy and as excited as what I think I should be? And he said, how many times did you visualize this, honey? And she said, Dad, I made it real in my mind so many times before this event. He said, you've already gone through the experience.
Yep.
And sure enough, she did. Because when we're getting into that state, our minds are making it real, and it's increasing our ability then to go out and produce that success. So it's a really fascinating thing, and stress management is really the key. And when we can eliminate that, everybody gets better. So quick things, if people are getting stressed on the course, loosen your grip pressure. Take time to walk with a rhythm and work on getting back into a rhythm instead of trying to tweak a mechanical part of their swing. and then check your thinking. And sometimes the thinking, people say, well, that's tough. Well, I give them three words that they can do, and everybody can do it, which is act as if. And if you simply begin acting as if you're feeling good, acting as if mm-hmm. you're positive, your body language will change. And by moving different, it will actually change the way you think and feel. So you'll see the best golfers on Sunday, the ones who are rolling, you watch their body language. Their body language is also keeping their emotions and their thoughts in check. So the young golfers out there, we say, be a professional. Act like those pros because you'll feel and think differently.
Well, a good example is, of course, this recent U.S. Open with when Keimer won. A lot of people, we talked about that earlier on the show as well. You know, he just walked, you know, really the 4 days in that perfect rhythm, and you could tell that he was really the master of his game. And you know, it's interesting, John, because you can always see in a situation where somebody might be going along in a tournament and you think, boy, they're in the zone, everything's going great, and then all of a sudden it's like they have a meltdown. And mm-hmm. all of a sudden, you know, they've lost the tournament, and everybody scratched their head. Well, wait a minute. He just played three great rounds of golf, and he gets in the fourth round on the Sunday, and everything's well. He's choked and that. But what's happening there? What's happening with golfers more often than not in a case like that where, you know, they've sort of been the master of their game for 2 or 3 days now, and it's getting into the final round of the tournament, and suddenly it just looks like, you know, where did this guy's golf game go? It just disappeared. Suddenly he's hitting bad shots. We saw that the British Open a number of years ago with, and I won't get into specifics, but one of the players that was doing well in the tournament, and all of a sudden on one hole, his whole round went to pieces. It's happened to many guys. What's happening in that process, do you think, you know, that's causing golfers even at that level to just suddenly have a meltdown?
Well, again, it's going back to the stress and the pressure. So here's an interesting thing, too. Watch their body language because you'll start seeing the shift. And what Martin Keimer did really well this past U.S. Open is even during adversity, he maintained his same state, his same body language. So here's why that's important. If you're standing tall and confident, it's easy to accept positive information because there's a congruency principle of mind. So if you're starting to walk around with your head down, shoulders slump, you're rehashing the past, and you try to say, okay, let's get confident to hit this shot, it's incongruent. Again, filters up, it gets shut down. So you'll see the body language is part of it, and you can start slowly seeing the decline there. So when the body language is going bad, that means emotions are changing, thoughts are changing. The other thing that I see, too, that it tends to happen in these situations is, believe it or not, golfers lose trust with what got them there. So, you know, a lot of golfers are process-oriented. So I can just speak, for example, for a couple of my guys. Whenever they're focused in their process and they're letting their process produce the result, they do really good. But now when they start getting out there and now they're putting the result ahead of their process, things start to fall apart. So you have a future-oriented thinking strategy that sometimes takes over with these guys, or they drag the past mistakes with them and say, well, I made these mistakes, how am I going to catch up? And it becomes a process. We always talk, if you're thinking in the positive, I mean the future, whether it's positive or negative, it's negative thinking on the course. You're thinking of the past, positive or negative, it's negative thinking. And so we use our way of staying present, focused through on our process. But then you might have another guy, like let's say a style of golfer like Bubba Watson. And I'm working with a guy right now who has a similar style of play. Sometimes those types of golfers will tend to then try to make it, they get a little more rigid, or they try to make it look a certain way, or it's got to be the certain way for them to close out the tournament, or trying to emulate someone like, I got to perform on Sunday like Tiger. And that might be counter what their natural way of going about that is. So oftentimes people just, they kind of lose trust with what their process that produced that. And for whatever reason, they sometimes try to change and go into something else. I mean, that answer is going to be specific or unique to each individual, but I hope that kind of gave a broad idea of some of those shifts away.
John, let me ask you, since you mentioned him, you know, mentioned Tiger. Actually, I want to talk about somebody else first. A really good example of what you were just talking about was really Greg Norman. If you look back in history, I mean, everybody knows his career and phenomenal golfer, very, you know, a great ball striker and that. But it's no secret, especially in the Masters, that he struggled in seemed to elude him, and U.S. Open and so on and so forth. But, you know, here was a situation where obviously he had the physical ability to be there with everybody else, but something mm-hmm. happened mentally during that process, because every time he would find himself in the hunt, he would just, you know, or he would be leading the Masters or you know, in one of the top five, all of a sudden it would just, he would fall, the bottom would fall out. Do you think this is a key example of somebody that sort of lost their rhythm, if you will, or their mental capacity?
Sure. I mean, sometimes it's just, it can even be a positive thing. He might be saying, well, I'm close to winning the Masters. This is my dream. Now he's walking along the course and he's not doing his process of focusing on the shot. So that could be something,
right,
too,
right,
that comes in to play. But oftentimes it's this too. We feel like we have to do something in those situations. I have to make something happen. I have to do this. I need this. And we're using a lot,
yep,
of language that has a lot of force and pressure. The goal in for peak performance, the zone state, and every golfer can relate to this, it's performance without conscious effort. It's states of relaxed awareness. And that's where mental discipline is really so important for that level, because it needs to be practiced. That's why we call our techniques mental fitness. Bob was on here,
right,
talking about physical fitness. You can't go to the gym or stretch one time and say, hey, I'm an athlete. That's ludicrous.
Right.
You can't go in and do one visualization technique and think that we can go out and perform. But there's this idea of pressing that I have to do it. And the interesting thing is your subconscious rebels against force. So the harder they're trying to force something to happen, that law of reverse effect takes place, which is, it's like trying to go to sleep at night. Oh, man, I got a meeting early. I got to go to bed. An hour later, I really, really got to go to bed. I'm trying to get to bed. Go to bed. And next thing you know, we're up all night. And it isn't until we finally throw our hands up in the air and surrender to let our instincts take over, our training take over, all those things that our subconscious already knows how to do. So we start thinking instead of performing. Conscious mind's the thinking part. That's for our decision-making. When we're over the ball, we want to have a quiet mind. Why? Because our brain already knows how to execute the golf shot and our best one. And it's about having that quiet, relaxed awareness instead of this need to press and force, and I have to make something happen. Now, some people thrive with that type of mentality and that personality, but not everybody. And even for those people who thrive with that mentality, it's their way of being peaceful inside, if that makes sense.
Right.
But that's what I see, too. It's like you see these guys, it's like their main dream. They've been working their whole life for this, and now they feel like, oh, I got to do something for it, instead of trusting and say, I prepared myself. I know what to do. My process works. It will work here. Let's hit this shot. And a lot of it, too, becomes also with labels. Labeling is a big thing. So suddenly you have a 150-yard shot. These guys hit them within 5 feet all the time, let's say. Suddenly now it's a 150-yard shot at the Masters.
Yeah.
Wow. That label, now we've changed this thing in our imagination again, has made it bigger than what it actually is. Same thing happens for all the average golfers. An average golfer gets a birdie putt. I have to make this. If not, I blew this hole. My gosh, this is my only birdie opportunity. I have to make it. That idea of birdie is changing state. The idea of a bogey, changing state. And they've tested this. They would go out with body reader or heart rate monitors and biofeedback machines, and they'd tell the kids, hey, this is just a five-footer. Let's see what you can do with it. And then they'd say,
right,
and not even in a performance context, this one's for birdie. State change, measurable physiological state change. This one's for par, same thing. This one's for bogey, same thing. And so part of the things that we work with our golfers on is removing those labels. The shot's a shot, the process is my process, and the situation may change, but my process stays the same. And this is what we drill into our golfers so that when they get behind into their pre-shot routine, it's a golf shot. And through hypnosis, we're able to eliminate the distractions. We get them into deliberate zones through mental triggers. And it's really cool to watch, and it's fast. And they can see immediate improvement, but it's the ongoing effort. It kind of creates compounding mental interest, if you will, everything stacks and gets a lot more cumulative.
John, let me ask you real quick, as we're getting down to the last few minutes here, I want you to make some comments, if you would, on another player. I just want to kind of get your thoughts on this, and then I want to give you an opportunity to maybe leave some parting thoughts with the audience, just some things to think about and how they can obviously get in touch with you if they want to learn more. But I want to ask you, the other player I wanted to talk to you about, of course, obviously is Tiger Woods. What are some things that you've noticed over the last few years? You know, everybody's picked apart his game and said, well, you know, he's made swing changes and things like that. That's really not what's going on here. You know, in my opinion, I think, you know, kind of like what you're talking about here, Tiger sort of lost his rhythm. Certainly he's still won some tournaments now, but compared to what we've seen in the past, it just looks different. You know, I'm sure he can still hit the ball just as well as he did, you know, 10 years ago.
Sure.
So I don't think it's really so much a swing. There's obviously a mental process that has changed in Tiger's game, and whatever's causing it, obviously we don't know unless we're in his head or talking to him. But just from your expert opinion, what are some thoughts that you would say that maybe what you're seeing that maybe Tiger's doing differently than he did before?
Well, one thing is that we give all of our golfers self-assessments coming in so we can understand how their minds are set up and operating. Now, one thing that I know from doing that work about Tiger is it's pretty obvious that when you look at Tiger when he was in his prime, he's an introverted golfer. Now, extroversion and introversion doesn't mean the desire to be around people. It's where we direct our energy towards. So extroverts like Bubba Watson, Phil Mickelson, they put their energy out into the moment. It's out in the crowd, in the action. Tiger at his prime, his mental energy as an introvert is directed towards his inner world of his own processes, tasks, and his job. And I remember being there at Oakmont with him, and he's standing right in front of me, and it wouldn't matter if there was thousands of people there or no people. He was in his space, and he never got out of that inner space. Now, here's what's interesting. If you're an introvert, when you get stressed, you get extroverted. Extroverts, when they get stressed, they get quiet. Watch Phil Mickelson. When he's in it, he's rocking around. He's revved up. When he's down, he's in his head. His head's down, and he's quiet. Tiger, on the other hand, you're going to see him directing his mental energy outward towards results, swing, people in the stands, all these things, and then you'll see him get extroverted. He'll either lash out, he'll hit his club down, and this is a sign of his stress mode. And like we talked about with stress, it's shutting down that part of the brain. And then I also see him playing relaxed like his normal way for those first 2-3 days. And then you see that press mode come in. That's a new feature, which is he didn't have before, where he had the mentality, hey, I'm in the final day. I'm winning this. That's it. If I just stay in my head and do my thing, that's it. It's done. Now I think his energy is getting directed more outside of himself. He's looking more at his swing. He's changing coaches. Tiger was great before when he went in first, and it's an inside-out process. And so that's why I think he's struggling. He's looking outside of himself to make that change. And what is it, instead of recentering back in his inner world, getting back into that mentality that he was when he was dominating? And that is a very introverted, very quiet, methodical type of approach. And this, when he's out getting outlandish or lashing out and all these things, he's done. You can just see it. It's a steady decline in his performance.
Yeah. Do you think, and when I say this, when I use the media, do you think that maybe the media had a little bit to do with that as well? And the reason why I say this, and let me just make this point, and then I'll let you respond, but you know, he was criticized very early on for playing that way, for being, you know, very much an introvert, very quiet, you know, methodical, and not sort of playing to the crowd, if you will. And I wonder if over time, and not being as, you know, as talkative as other players, like a lot of players that were paired up with him, you know, you might have, say, a Lee Trevino personality, and Tiger Woods was not a Lee Trevino personality. Do you think that over time, just some of the criticism, too, got to him a little bit, and maybe he felt, okay, I need to be a little bit more personable here, and that sort of took him away from his rhythm?
You know, that could have something to do with it. I mean, when your personal life gets leaked out all over for everybody to see, and now you have some PR type of things, too, that you have your team around to maintain sponsors and endorsements and things. Certainly I could see something like that coming into play, for sure. But, you know, at the same time, I give credit to Tiger for is his genius is in figuring out how his mind and his unique personality works. And the greatest thing that he did when he was at his prime was he didn't bend that for anybody. And, in fact, he took the extroverts out of their game by having them not talk. Now he's getting them in the stress. And what happened when they were with Tiger? It was the Tiger effect. I mean, people couldn't play.
Yep.
Why? You got 500 media people running around you. You got all this stuff, and then there's Tiger Woods staring down there looking like Superman and no fear, no emotion or anything. That was his big mental game. And Tiger really, I mean, that's psychological stuff out that made him a great competitor. And that's what I really like. But here's the thing for all the young kids out there. It's not a matter of modeling him. It's about this finding your uniqueness and being like yourself. And the more you can be you on the course, the more you can get into the zone state. I see a lot of kids that are extroverted talkers. They're excited. They're in the action. They try to be like Tiger, and then they can't hit the ball. Vice versa. And so we talk about the zone has a couple things. The zone is a relaxed state of awareness and you being you, trusting your game, trusting your skill sets. And on the other side of the spectrum, you get guys like Zach Johnson who have become just absolutely incredible competitors, but they're not hitting the ball 340. He's owned his game. He knows himself, and he's letting himself be unique, and he's become very successful. And that's what I like for the young kids out there or for parents. Don't try to make him like Tiger, but see what Tiger is doing that is role model worthy. The emphasis into the physical athleticism, the aspect of the mental part of it, and finding that person to develop that side, the commitment to the craft, the professionalism, but not always to do those on-course keys like he does, because that's kind of unique for his personality type, unless you're that way, you know. So
exactly. John, very quickly, if you want, let the folks that are tuning in tonight, let them know how they can get in touch with you if they want, if they're interested in learning more, and also where they can get a copy of your book, Golfer's Guide to Mental Fitness.
Well, the Golfer's Guide to Mental Fitness is really the user manual to the golfer's brain. It's going to walk you through step-by-step on actually how to empower yourself to do all these things that we're talking about. It's actually going to be due out. We got the proof today, so in about a week or two, you can find it on Amazon. That's available. And if anybody wants to get hypnotized now, they can go to mentalcaddy.com, and you can basically get your own mental coach right there at your beck and call. And we give everybody for signing up with the email a free sample. So it's there for increasing your course confidence. Download it, listen to it, and go out and beat your buddies. And that's at mentalcaddy.com. And for private coaching, for any of the serious golfers out there, it's mentalgolfacademy.com. They can reach me there.
Fantastic. John, I want to thank you very much for coming on the program tonight. It's certainly been a very interesting conversation, and I mean, we could go on for hours and hours. I wish I had hours more to talk about this, and I would love to have you come back. If you turn into the beginning of the program, I talked about a new series that I run. A part of the program is a Coach's Corner panel where we get some of the pros out there to come in and talk about some of the different ways that we can help some of the golfers out there, and you bring a very unique perspective that I would love to add in there. So I'll communicate with you outside of the program, of course, but I would love to maybe have you participate in a few of those segments.
I would love to. I'm all in.
And input.
Yeah,
I'm
all in on
that.
I heard the earlier part, and I thought that's a brilliant program and a brilliant plan, and it's showing people the full spectrum on what it takes to get to that level where everybody's aspiring to get to. So
right.
I think
that there's – yeah, John, I would love to have you participate in that. I think, as I said, you bring a great perspective. But, John Weir, I want to thank you very much, and I'm certainly going to get a copy of your book when it's available. And if you can when exactly is it going to be coming out?
I'm not exactly sure. It'll be there probably first or second week of July, but I can send out some messages, and people can connect with me on Twitter. It's at MentalCaddy, and they'll be able to get some updates and things on there as well. But, Ted, thank you so much for having me on. This has been awesome.
Yeah, not a problem, John. I appreciate it, and you're welcome to come back anytime. And as I said, I'm going to there's just too much really to cover. There's so many other things that we unfortunately didn't have time to get to, but I want to have you back and participate in some of the Coach's Corner panel segments, because I think with this new series that I'm starting, in the next few weeks, and that I think would be a lot of fun. So, John, if you're available, we'll tee that up, and as I say, and coordinate that with your schedule as well. But John, I would rather just can't emphasize enough how much I appreciate you coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. I love being on here, and thanks for giving me an opportunity to spread the word.
Not a problem. Thank you very much, and you have a great evening and a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, too.
All right, bye-bye. Okay, that was my very special guest, John Weir. And as we were just talking about, he's the author of The Golfer's Guide to Mental Fitness. It's going to be coming available on Amazon.com real soon, and I'll make an announcement once that's official. Just to help him out. And also, you can get a hold of Jonathan through the mentalcaddy.com website. And just a great, great conversation, a great great young man that's just got a lot of insight into really the mind and how it works. And I think this is something that people need to understand. It's not just the physical part of the game. It's the mental side of the game as well. And I can't think of a better person to have on the Coach's Corner panel here. So, again, if you want to get in touch with John, you can also, I see he's got another website here, johnweirhypnosis.com. Certainly if you want to reach out to him there as well, but also you can check up the mentalcaddy.com website as well and get in touch with him that way. But I appreciate everybody tuning in tonight. And as I said, I'm going to be starting in the next few weeks, we're going to be starting the new segment, part of the Coach's Corner panel, Plan for Success. I want all of you to tune in, start spreading the word right now. I think it's going to be a great addition to the program. A lot of great things coming up as we get through the summer part of the programming and into the fall. So make sure you tune in each and every week here on blogtalkradio.com, Golf Talk Live, and we're live every Thursday at 6 to 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. And if you want to reach out to me personally, you can do so through my email at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. Maybe you know somebody like John or somebody else in the golf industry that you think would be a great great asset to the program. I'm certainly all ears, as it were. You can email me through ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. And don't forget, live during the broadcast, anytime from 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday evenings, you can call into the program if you have questions either for myself or for any of the guests. Or you want to talk to the people on the Coach's Corner panel, you can do so by calling area code 646-716-4667. And don't forget, if you want to clue into the link, it's blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive. Get updates on social media, facebook.com/golftalkliveblog, and make sure you like us there as well. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Ted and Buck CEO, CEO is in caps. And also check out the Golf Talk Live website at golftalkliveblog.com. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week. And I want to thank also all of you around the world that tune into the program. And specifically, I want to thank Robert Foreman and Mike Lawrence for joining in on the panel tonight. Great discussion, guys. Thanks, as always. And, of course, my special guest, John Weir. And I can't be remiss if I didn't thank some of the great people that promote and sponsor this show. Jonathan Laird of South Coast Golf Guide, who's been a big supporter of the program. Meredith Kirk, of course, Meredith Kirk Golf. Nikki and Tiffany Litherland, and, of course, Mr. Bernie Pinder of Ontic Golf, and my buddy across the pond, the big pond, as I say, Mr. Peter Doyle of Doyle Golf Solutions over in Ireland. Thanks, everybody, for helping out with the program. And don't forget to tune in also every Tuesday morning on blogtalkradio.com, Women of Golf, with, of course, none other than LPGA professional Cindy Miller and myself. That's every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Eastern time. Have a great weekend, as I said, everybody, and I will see you back here Thursday, 6 p.m. Central Standard Time next week, right here on Golf Talk Live. Thanks, everybody. God bless.